Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 175 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I am so happy that you are here today. Before we dive into the interview, I want to say that today's episode is brought to you by snapcardster.com/Kickstarter. So Snapcardster is a really cool new app that is coming out. The developers want to take it from Android to the iOS, and they have a lot of really cool features to make this an all-in-one magic app. Their flagship feature is a super fast card scanning tool that's going to let you categorize your collection super fast. They're also going to have swipe to sell, swipe to buy, a local trading option, as well as a magic news timeline, which I think is really cool. This episode is also brought to you by the patrons. Patrons, thank you so much. We've had a couple people sign up this past week, and it's been amazing to just receive your support and feel your love. I really appreciate it. I love doing this show. I love giving back to the community and helping you improve. The goal is to help 1,000 players qualify for the Pro Tour, and I hope that you are one of them. And it's because of the patrons that we're able to keep the lights on and keep the wheels greased and keep rolling forward. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you're interested in becoming a patron, you can go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon to learn more about that. Basically, you pledge any amount you want per episode and set a monthly limit so that you never go out of budget. So thank you so much to the patrons, and snapcardster.com/Kickstarter is a cool new magic app that if you're interested in backing, you can go check that out. That's really it for the top of the interview stuff. Not a lot going on. We are in between GP weekends for sure, with Pittsburgh being last weekend, and I'll be reaching out to the top eight there and bringing them on the show. So we do have an awesome guest today who has an incredible journey through Magic that I can't wait to share with you. So without further ado, let's bring him in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I am super excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest has cashed many Grand Prix and has one Grand Prix top eight and a Pro Tour top 32, both in 2016. He's a silver level pro looking to continue the success he had last year, this year. Coming to us from Rochester, New York, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Eric English. Eric, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Fantastic. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
Sure thing.
Excellent. Now, prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Eric, you can do so on Twitter. He's at English_Eric. So you can reach out to him there, say thanks for being on the show, ask him a question, whatever, what have you there. So, Eric, we love learning a little bit about our guests outside of Magic before we do the whole Magic thing. So are you born and raised in Rochester, New York?
I am. Yeah. I grew up here. I didn't go to school very far away. I went to college over in Ithaca. I went to Cornell University for my undergrad, but I moved back home, and I've been working here full time after I graduated from college.
Excellent. What do you do?
I work at the Red Cross. There we have a regional building here in Rochester that covers like the state.
Okay.
And I work in the lab. I do quality control.
Wow. Okay. Excellent. Excellent. So you do that for your job, and then obviously Magic as your main hobby, and doing quite well at that. Do you have any siblings that you play Magic with? Or are you a lone wolf as far as that's concerned?
No, I have one sister, but she doesn't play. She has no interest in the game. I play a lot with people that I've known either here in the state or especially back at home. I'm more or less like the top dog in Rochester, so I know pretty much everyone who wants to play competitively in the area. And I know a lot of people in the state too, just from I've played, let's see, back since Onslaught, so that's like 13 years or so by now, or maybe more. So I've come to know almost everybody in the state as far as the competitive Magic scene goes.
Awesome. You're the end boss, as they say.
I mean, at least in Rochester.
Yeah, in Rochester. Yeah, yeah. You are your local area's end boss.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, perfect dovetail into your history with Magic. So you mentioned, you know, kind of when you came in, but take us there with you. We want a story of the first time that you saw or played Magic cards. How did you see them? How did you get introduced to it? What was that like?
Sure. So I got introduced by my friends in high school, probably a story that's, you know, mirrored by a lot of other people.
No, that's actually quite unique.
Oh, sure. Anyways, yeah, so, God, when was that? Back when I was a freshman in high school? So, yeah, that was about 13 years ago, give or take. And I started playing based off the cards that they gave me. And after I started going to my local game store and playing, you know, I played FNM on and off. And I started collecting enough cards to be able to play more constructed formats. And I didn't really start playing super competitively until about when I was in college. So about 8 or 9 years ago, I started playing more competitively. I started playing a lot of Legacy because there was a pretty good Legacy scene up here in upstate New York. So I played that as like my first real competitive format. And then I slowly got better at everything else until now I'm pretty much good at everything.
Love it. And so you said you came in on Onslaught. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just about. Yeah, I think when I joined, when I started playing, I think Scourge had just came out. So I guess tail end of Onslaught Block.
Cool. And what's your favorite set?
Favorite set? Oh, let's see. Has to be original Innistrad, I'd have to say. Yeah, Snapcaster Mage is like one of my favorite cards of all time. Innistrad is probably my favorite limited format of all time. Spider Spawning is my favorite archetype in any limited format.
Excellent.
Across the ages. And there's a bunch of other awesome Innistrad cards that got printed. I mean, things like, you know, Liliana of the Veil got printed in that set. Geist Atriarch got printed in that set. There's all sorts of... I mean, it also is just like huge flavor win too. Like, the set was just one of the best things that's ever been made as far as Magic is concerned.
Yeah, agreed. So along the same lines, what is one of your favorite cards? So you can either go with Snapcaster Mage or a different one.
My favorite card actually is Engineer Explosives. So
so for those of us who don't know, what is it, what does it do, and why do you like it?
So Engineer Explosives originally was printed in 5th Dawn. It also was reprinted in Modern Masters. Engineer Explosives, if for anyone who plays Modern, they probably have seen it or played it with it or against it. Let's see. So it is an artifact, command cost X. It has Sunburst, so for as many different colors of mana that you put into it, you get that many counters on it, and you can pay 2 to sack it, and it destroys all non-land permanents with the number of counters on it. So aside from being an awesome card, it has fantastic art. The original 5th Dawn art has a bunch of elephants being blown up by this one guy in the background, and it also is my initials, so people have called me EE a lot.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so Engineer Explosives kind of has that little soft spot in my heart. I have some original art of the card. I don't have the original oil painting. I'll never get that. The guy who owns it will never give it up in his life. But I do have some of the original. I have some of the like the preliminary artwork, and I have like 12 or 13 foil copies of the card. I have a play set of Japanese foils, actually.
Love it. Well, hey, man, all you have to do is set up a Google alert and then just show up at his estate sale when he dies. And hopefully his family doesn't know the worth.
I do have some crazy supervillain plans to be able to get it. But
excellent. You watch a lot of heist movies.
Yeah. Unless I become a multimillionaire or become like some world-class thief, I don't think I'll ever get my hands on it. But that's okay. No, I really do like the card quite a bit. I think it's pretty awesome.
That because it destroys all cards with converted mana cost equal to the counters on it, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so I've definitely gotten destroyed by that because in Modern, my first deck that I played competitively in Modern was Bogles. And there's a lot of one mana spells in my deck. And that.
Oh, yeah.
And I basically have no artifact interaction at all. So people will just play that card. I'm like, well, next turn I'm dead. That's it.
Yep. Oh, yeah. No, that card is a house. I mean, I'm so glad that it's finally, like, the last, like, year, it's really gotten its, like, time in the spotlight in Modern. Like, obviously the price has gone up pretty dramatically over the last year or two. It's worth like $40 or something at this point.
Oh my god, I didn't know it was up there. That's crazy.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it sees a lot of play. It sees play in a lot of main decks now. It's an excellent sideboard card. It's been excellent for the entire time it's been legal, but not a lot of people are really paying attention to it until the last couple of years when it's really gotten some more limelight action.
Yeah, I love it. Now, you mentioned that you started getting more competitive in Magic when you went off to college, which is interesting. I want to touch on that real quick because several of our guests stepped back from Magic when they went to college because they were busy, this, that, and the other. And you said you went to Cornell for your undergrad, so it's not like, you know, some easy peasy walk in the park school. It's like prestigious, right. And I'm sure the workload was pretty high. So how did that look? How did you balance, you know, student at a good school and also stepping up your Magic game?
Well, so the real reason that happened was that there was a games club at Cornell that I attended pretty often, and the games club had a lot of like really, really good players. I mean, people that didn't really travel for tournaments, but they were, you know, like excellent, excellent technical and intuitive players. And I learned a lot from them in my time while I was there. So like I was able to balance schoolwork barely. I didn't do nearly as well as I wanted to, but I mean, I was able to graduate with not any issues. And like the real level up that I got was just playing with people who are better than me, who like basically got me to a point where I could go like start top 80 in PTQs at a more regular rate, go to Grand Prix and make day two pretty consistently, and make me start thinking about the game and more high level ideas versus, you know, going to my FNM and just like doing the same thing that I was always doing back when I was in high school.
Right. That's awesome. It's really neat that the support system at school was in place and you're able to, you know, rub shoulders and play with some really good players and level up while still at school. You know, that's great. At least at the very least, probably cut down on the commute. That's nice.
I was pretty lucky that there was a good solid number of players in the area who were good at a lot of different things. Especially there were a lot of people at Cornell who were really good at limited. Getting better at limited was really helpful in making me better at the rest of my game.
Sweet. So when you started getting more serious about Magic, what was an aspect that you struggled with or that you were even terrible at, but that you eventually overcame?
I'd have to say that my deck selection originally was like pretty bad. I pretty much would just like pick whatever I like thought was either fun or what I thought would be like my favorite deck. I didn't really consider like the metagame, I guess. Like, I mean, it's nowadays it's very easy for people to like go read articles about the overall metagame just because there's so many tournaments and there's so much data that like the information comes out very quickly and people are able to get like a pretty good edge if they pay attention. But back in like, you know, this was back in the 2008, 2009 era, where there wasn't nearly as much like data, like the Star City circuit hadn't gotten as big as it was. And I mean, there was still like a lot of data to be had, but it wasn't as prevalent, I guess, as it is now. And yeah, like being able to really like think about what I should be playing and how I should play it was pretty important. That's another thing too, that I basically was able to learn how to like play the game at any like archetype, like being able to play like anything from the most aggressive deck to the most controlling deck possible and everything in between. So once I figured out how to be able to just like think about the game in those terms, I got a lot better.
That's awesome. That's really neat. And I love your point of there's so much data out there now that you're able to kind of see what the meta is actually like, which informs your deck selection as opposed to just kind of picking what you think will, you know, fit you better or whatever. So that's really neat.
Right. Yeah. That's something I try and tell people at my local, like my local area a lot, is that like a lot of people are still stuck in playing what they like. Like a lot of people, you know, like some people in modern, they love to play like the Tron deck. They love to play like, you know, the Blood Moon deck. They love to play the Wild the Coddle deck or all those, you know, type of not quite, I guess I would call them like micro archetypes. Like, I mean, macro is like, you know, aggro combo control or whatever. But like, if you think about like micro archetypes, basically like I'd put them at like certain styles of decks. Like the Wild the Coddle example, like some people just have to play a deck with Wild the Coddle in it. But sometimes Wild the Coddle is not very good and you can't just play Wild the Coddle all the time. Because if you do, sometimes you're just going to get destroyed. And you have to like pick and choose your battles, like when you want to play this card and when you should play something different that's better positioned. So like having a wide range of decks that you can play gives you the ability to pick and choose what's best positioned at any given time.
Yeah, one advice that pops to mind when you say that was a past guest basically said, if you have, you know, at least two different decks that attack the meta from different axes. So for example, you have a creature based deck that you're really good at, and then you have, say, like a combo deck that, you know, so one deck is focused on bringing your opponent's life total from 20 to 0 as quickly as possible. The other one wants to combo off or whatever. Then kind of based on the meta, you can say, all right, this weekend when I go to this tournament, I'm going to take, and this is a little easier with, you know, more eternal formats as opposed to standard. But then you say, when I'm going to go to this event this weekend, I'm going to take my combo deck because of the meta, or my creature based deck because of the meta. And so that's more or less sounds along the same lines, what you're saying, kind of be familiar and be able to adapt and play different styles.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think it's pretty important. It's something that doesn't really come into consideration for a lot of people because they're just so enamored with certain things. Like the fun aspect takes over their logic, if you want to think about it that way. But if your goal is to win, you really should just use logic. I mean, I personally think that every aspect of the game is fun. So I don't have that issue. But I think that if you plan on trying to win as much as you can, then you should pick whatever is best positioned. If you want to have as much fun as you can just go play EDH. I mean, I love to play EDH, but I'm not looking to like play an EDH deck at, you know, a Grand Prix. I'm looking to play the deck that's going to get me pro points, basically.
So when would you say was your breakthrough as a Magic player?
My breakthrough, I would say, was probably about, let's see, I guess it was about 2.5 years ago. But at this point, I was kind of just playing along. Hadn't really been like doing any like crazy results or anything like that. And just playing locally, doing pretty well locally. And there was a Star City Open that happened in Syracuse. I think this was in 2014, I think. Yeah, I think it was in 2014. So this was, yeah, about 2.5 years ago during the summer. And this was back when M15, Seventh Goblin Realm Master, just came out. And Rabble Red debuted at the Pro Tour just a few weeks prior. I think it was like 2 weeks before the SCG Open. And I just looked at the results from the Pro Tour. It's like, I have no idea what to play. I started playtesting a few different decks. I played like one game with Rabble Red, and I was like, oh man, this deck is just like absurd. I'm just going to play it. Screw it. This deck is ridiculous. And I was right. And I basically just, I took the list that I think Tom Ross wrote an article about the deck maybe like a day or two before the SCG Open, and I just went and bought all the cards from my local game stores and just played the tournament with no games played. Just picked up the deck cold, and I got second. Like, I probably should have won the whole thing, but I unfortunately played against one Jared Betcher, who you may or may not have heard of. he has been banned,
yeah,
for cheating.
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
I played against him in the finals.
You played him in the finals, okay.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if he did anything weird in our match. I have no idea, but...
But the thing is, now with hindsight, everyone who's ever played him is always thinking, did I lose because he cheated, or did I lose because I actually lost? So
yeah, I have no idea. That's sad. I mean, granted, I know, looking back at that match, it was on video, and I know I didn't play it in the finals particularly well, but I did play all my other matches very well. So yeah, after that, I just got to be able to think about the game in much better terms. It's kind of hard for me to pinpoint exactly like what the changing in my like thought process was, but I was pretty much able to just like think about decks and more or less understand like what they are, how they work, and then most importantly, like how they interacted with the other decks, because that's something that a lot of people kind of fall short on when they're trying to like figure out what's well positioned. They can figure out how their own deck works, but it's also very important to understand how it interacts with everybody else. Once you understand that, then you can really figure out that next level and be able to really get an edge on your opponents who aren't thinking about the same thing on your end.
So as you have improved as a Magic player, has there ever been any advice from a pro, either that you've read or maybe they've told you or whatever, that has really stuck with you?
Yeah, there's been a few things. I guess I'm trying to think as far as like articles that I've read. I mean, I pretty much just try to be like as objective as possible. I prefer to like avoid generalizations that some people might make. I really like articles that are trying to just be like very objective and just giving you like data and then allowing you to come to your own conclusions without force feeding you the like logical conclusion, air quotes. At least that's the way I think about it. And there's also one of my good friends, John Sikenik, who I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he's a very good player from New Jersey who's won a couple of Moto PDQs. He'll be in Nashville. But he talked to me recently at the last Pro Tour, not the one in Dublin, but the one in Hawaii. He talked to me about just the way that you can think about Magic and testing, and there's really a lot of like space in the game that allows you to just like think about it instead of having to just like jam a bunch of games. So a lot of players really like the approach of just, oh, I'm going to just play like 100 games, then I'm going to know everything. Like that's their philosophy about like understanding how the game works. but you can really learn a lot by just like theory crafting and just talking with other people and taking a much more like, I guess, philosophical approach versus like a data driven approach. And it does work. Like you can really get some good data just trying to think about the game. And that's something that I do personally. I don't play nearly as much as other people. Some of my friends, they kind of laugh when I tell them, they're like, oh yeah, I haven't played this deck whatsoever. And then I top eight or whatever. And they're just like, how'd you do that? And I'm just like, I don't know. I just thought about it. It's weird. A lot of players I know are like very particular in the fact that they like have to play on Modo, you know, like 3 hours a day. They have to get like hundreds of matches in to understand decks. And for me, I like thinking about them and thinking about how they operate, how they operate against other things, like what I should be looking for in game, and then just executing it after thinking about it. And then it often works for me.
That's awesome. That is really incredible. And I think that's worth noting. And you're definitely not the only one who has talked about theory crafting and its benefits and saying that like not everything that you do has to be turning cardboard sideways and so data driven, like you said. So that's really neat to hear from different people so that it gives, you know, the listeners an opportunity to explore different angles when they're trying to level up their game. So that's really neat. So as we go through Magic, we all have, you know, ups and downs, but our ups and downs are unique to each person. And so we would love to dive into first your worst Magic moment and what you learned from that experience.
So this one's pretty easy to remember. My worst Magic moment definitely was, this is way back when I was still in college. There was a very small, like, invite only tournament that was hosted for like this Legacy series. Basically, there was a game store down in Binghamton that used to host like monthly Legacy tournaments that had a pretty good turnout all the time. They usually had like, you know, 60 plus players every month.
Gosh. Wow.
Oh yeah, no, they did a really good job back in the day getting people to play Legacy. And so there was like this invite only tournament based on, they kind of modeled it after the SCG circuit, because you know how a lot of stores have taken the SCG system and made it kind of smaller for their own local store and made like, you know, like yearly invite tournaments. And so this store did that one here and I qualified for it. I got some buys into the tournament, and based on the way that my tournament started, like I should have made the top eight incredibly easy. Like I should have had no issue getting there. And I ended up falling short where I had a match that I probably should have won, where I had a draw, like an unintentional draw, that my opponent was dead for top eight. And instead of conceding to me, he drew with me because he thought he was live, even though he was mistaken. And I got kind of upset. And the next match, I ended up playing a friend who just kind of, you know, dream crushed me very quickly. Like I just didn't stand a chance. And I got even more upset. And I pretty much made a gigantic fool of myself in that one moment. And oh, man, I was so embarrassed. Holy crap. That was easily my lowest point in my Magic career. I basically was like a 2-year-old child throwing a tantrum in a store. It was not pretty. I pretty much took like a month or so and just didn't play whatsoever and just thought about what I had done and realized like it wasn't worth it. Like I just had no reason to do any of that stuff. And I, at that point, tried to just get myself to be better and better and better. And I've made a lot of progress. I'm not perfect. I have gotten a lot better at this point. Tilt used to be like a pretty big issue. And that was easily the time where I tilted off the most. And at this point, I've gotten almost immune to it. I still experience it from time to time. Mostly if I like make a mistake, I tilt it myself, but I don't tilt at my opponents.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for taking us there and for opening up and sharing that with us. And the point is not obviously just to, you know, lay yourself out there for kicks and giggles. We really want to be able to take from that and learn from that. And so obviously now that we're very well separated from it and you have hindsight and you're able to evaluate it, what can you share with us about tilt? Like what have you done since then to better manage it, to overcome it, so that maybe those out there who are struggling with the same thing be like, oh, you know, that's me, or I'm right there on the edge. They can maybe learn something of how to combat it.
Yeah. So it was like I'd say that there were two parts to it. One, obviously it's just incredibly embarrassing. And if you want to like, you know, live your life trying to be doing good things. I mean, I think most people try to live their lives just doing good instead of bad. I mean, that seems to be the general consensus amongst most human beings. And so on one end, obviously I wanted to just be like a good person and try to not be a gigantic, terrible ass to other people. And on the other end, I also realized that Tilt was really just incredibly detrimental to getting better and just performing at this game. So over time, I've come to think about the game in terms of like just a lot of the game I think about in terms of like resource management. I mean, that's generally like a lot of people can think about it, like, you know, mana, cards, whatever. Like there's a lot of resources to manage when playing the game. And like your the way that you carry yourself outside of a match also is part of your resource management. Oh, it's your own excellent. Personal energy resource management. So if I'm spending a bunch of time getting angry and frustrated, and even if it's just something as simple as kind of beating myself up after a match, being like, oh man, I should have done this, I should have done this, I should have done this, and then going to my friends and talking to them about how I've felt so angry or frustrated or anything like that, like it doesn't accomplish anything. All it does is take away my mental energy from the next match, which actually matters. So to me right now, tilting is really just, it doesn't do anything beneficial. All it does is do something detrimental. So I think that it's just better to just not do it.
That is awesome. I really, really like that. You know, your emotions and your mental energy is just another resource that you have to manage. I love that because lots of people think of Magic in terms of resource management because, you know, like you said, mana and cards and all these things that we track. But I would be shocked if there are a, you know, a large group of people who think of their emotions and the mental energy as a resource to be managed. That was an eye opener for me. So I think that's awesome. What a wonderful way to view it. And I'm really glad that we had you on the show so we can dive into that and share that because I just had an epiphany listening to you. So that's really, really cool. I think that's great. I think that's really great. Obviously, on the flip side are our highs and our proud Magic moments. So what has been your proudest Magic moment to date?
Proudest Magic moment, I'd have to say, is I guess I would say winning. I have one SCG Open win that I got on a trip to Seattle that I took on a whim. So I had an invitational that I was qualified for. This is back in 2014, I think. Yeah, 2014. So back in 2014, this was also after I had that SCG Open finals finish. I was qualified for some invitationals, and I decided, you know what? I'll visit my friend who works at Microsoft. I decided to go take a visit to Seattle, go visit him, had a blast. And decided to just play in the Invitational for the fun of it. Scrubbed out of the Invitational, but then I got to go to play in the Open instead. And I decided to, once again, pick up a deck cold. I built the Sidisi Whip just all out of the cards I owned. I think I bought a few Doomwick Giants before the tournament started. And then I just won the whole thing. I just played the deck and just, you know, it was, all right, this is how I play the deck. And I played very, very well, and I just made next to no mistakes, and it just felt great. I got to, even though a lot of my friends weren't there or whatever, I got to actually hang out with my friend from high school, and he got to watch me win, and I got to just enjoy that moment where I actually, you know, had the trophy in my hands.
That's really cool.
Yeah, there's, you know, even if you have like great results in the game, like, you know, someone who has a bunch of GP top eights, even it can be still hard to get that trophy. The trophies are really hard to get, like the very big ones. The ones for SCG Opens and for Grand Prix are just incredibly difficult to attain. So even if you have like, you know, fantastic results, you still might not have a trophy.
Right.
So owning that trophy, like I can see it from where I'm standing right now. Just a nice little reminder that I did earn that one.
Man, that's awesome. That is so cool. And that's really neat. Like you said, many people who have top results don't always get the trophy. And so being able to have that, take it home, like that's really neat. So, man, I usually dive into, okay, like what were you doing leading up to that event? But in this particular case, you picked up the deck, you know, kind of cold after scrubbing out of a different tournament. So, but I guess more than that deck or that event specifically, what have you been doing to kind of keep your edge up and to keep your skill level where it needs to be? Because obviously you wouldn't be able to just go to an event and pick up a deck without doing anything. So what are some of your training habits?
It's funny you ask me that because The one Grand Prix top end I have, I also picked up the deck called.
Really? Yeah. So your secret is just for you, don't do anything. Just show up and go.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I know. It's a little silly. Oh man.
Hey, you know, everyone's different. That's totally fine. We'll still get awesome nuggets like the one earlier, you know, from our conversation here, but that's fine.
Yeah, I the one thing I really do though is I just actively think about I do a lot of theory crafting about what the metagame looks like and then acting on it. So like in the example I just alluded to with my Grand Prix top eight, this was Grand Prix Detroit from last year. And obviously everyone knew going in that Eldrazi was the best thing you could possibly do. Like playing four Eldrazi Temple and four Ivugan and then 52 other Eldrazi cards was just like the best thing you could ever do at that tournament. It wasn't even remotely close. And I just looked at the results from Magic Online and thought about, okay, which ones are like, which Eldrazi decks are well positioned? Like, how should I build my deck? And I just decided that red green was very well positioned. It basically had game versus the blue white deck and trounced everything else. And so I played it and I was right. And the deck did actually just trounce everything else. And the only decks I ever lost in that tournament were blue-white, Eldrazi. Those are my only two losses in the whole tournament. So, I mean, for me, like, my edge is much more based on, instead of spending time playing the game, I spend a lot of time thinking about it. Like, when I'm at work and I have nothing to do, you know, I can think about it a little bit.
So let's dive into that. What does theory crafting for you, what does that look like? Like, I mean, yeah, walk us through a process or something, a little more detail of what that process looks like for you.
Sure. So for me, like a lot of theory that I think about comes down to like card interaction and basically like the hierarchy of this card, like card A versus card B, and then card C versus card, you know, B and A, and then so on and so forth, adding everything else. Obviously, there's too many to actually name, but
when's the most recent time that you can think of, you know, that you were, had a good, I guess, theory crafting session for an event coming up or whatever? And then we can just kind of use that as specific examples so you can kind of walk us through.
Sure. So I guess I will use the last Grand Prix that I played in. So the last Grand Prix I played in was in Louisville, which was Legacy. And leading up to it, I really didn't have any idea what I was going to play. I thought that Cabal Therapy was a good, well-positioned card, so I tried a bunch of Cabal Therapy decks.
And why did you think that?
Well, basically, I thought that the card, like the way that most Cabal Therapy decks were built, they basically had a lot of value built in, so they were good versus miracles, and they had just, and the value also, like certain cards that you get to play, like in particular Baleful Strix, is actually very good because it means that if you're building your deck with Baleful Strix in mind, most of the time you have like a pretty good miracles matchup based on the way the deck is built. And it's also that card in particular is very good versus Eldrazi, which sees a lot of play at Grand Prix due to its like cost. The deck isn't that expensive. I mean, all the creatures are all almost all of them are standard legal.
So you started with, you know, some knowledge, which is the best deck in this particular format is Miracles. And then another good deck that's pretty popular is Eldrazi. And so with that in mind, you're kind of thinking, okay, what has good matchups against that? And you settled on Cabal Therapy and Baleful Strix. And so take us from that point.
Okay. So I tried some Cabal Therapy decks and they were okay, but they weren't anything special. Like I didn't really have an edge in some matchups. And I just decided that it wasn't quite good enough. And so I kind of went back to the drawing board, thought a little bit about some of the other decks that were available. And one of my friends kept mentioning Food Chain to me. So the deck actually has a soft spot in my heart because I played it in the past to a lot of success several years ago. And the deck looked pretty similar, but the big upgrade that it got was it got to play Leovold, Emissary of Trest, which was another card I thought that was incredibly well positioned, but I hadn't figured out a deck to play it in. So I realized that I could play Baleful Strix and Leovold in this deck while also having this combo engine. So I got to have free wins and I got to have an excellent Miracles matchup. Both times I played against Miracles of the I had pretty easy times winning the game. And so I pretty much put the pieces together and thought about the way that it was set up against most of the metagame. Even though Legacy is obviously very wide open, there's several archetypes that still hold like pretty large percentages of most Grand Prix, namely Miracle is usually number one, Eldrazi behind it, and then you have things like Death and Taxes, Ver, Sneak and Show.
So you're thinking about Miracles, you're thinking about Eldrazi, you're thinking about, you said, Death and Taxes and some of the other big decks. And so when you talk about thinking about the matchup, are you thinking, all right, so this deck, Miracles, is going to do this on turn 2 and 3. What am I doing on turn 2 and 3? Is that kind of how you think through things, or what does that actually look like when you're thinking about it?
For me, it's more about, it's not really like thinking about a specific turn. It's more about just thinking, I guess I'm trying to think of like an analogy I can use to describe like my line of thought. Like when I'm thinking about the game, I tend to think about, I guess it's flow and a bigger scale, like
the dialogue between the decks, like what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, like I'm more thinking about like what's going to be happening over the course of like 8 to 10 turns, not the course of like 1 or 2. Because a lot of the time, a lot of games obviously are not going to. I mean, there's critical turns, but like understanding the flow of like what will happen, the push pull for like one deck's going to have an action, the other deck's going to react to it, and then so on and so forth, and it goes off from there. And thinking about like the way that they're interacting as time goes on, and thinking about it on like that scale is the way that I tend to think about the game. I don't tend to think about like it turn on a turn by turn basis. Like a lot of like that's something that I try to avoid, like getting pigeonholed into, is just like, you know, the okay. Turn, okay, what do I do? And then next turn, okay, what do I do? What do I do? Like, for me, my thought process is, okay, my game plan is to sculpt, like, this scenario over the course of the next, like, 8 to 10 turns. Or maybe it's something shorter, like, sometimes, you know, you can have that combo hand where it's like, okay, I'm going to set myself up to combo on turn 5 in this scenario after I've expended all my opponent's resources in one shape or form. And there's obviously all sorts of iterations of this kind of process, but like my thought process is much more of a, like a entire game, like how the entire game will play out, instead of just how is like turn 1 or turn 2 going to play out.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. All right. Very neat, man. That's really interesting. I love hearing that process going through, like how you identify, you know, from the beginning, and then you came up with key pieces, like Cabal Therapy is, you know, good in this particular meta, and then also Leovold was good, and you said Baleful Strix, and so you were able to put those pieces together. So that's really neat how you kind of walk through and were able to pick out and build a deck around these pieces that you feel were well positioned. So that's really neat. Thanks. Thank you for walking us through that process. So as you've played Magic and obviously played thousands of games against hundreds of people and so many lines of play, what has been the biggest mistake that you see players make? And then how can we avoid that mistake?
The biggest mistake, let's see, trying to think about, I mean, there's plenty of small mistakes. I guess the biggest mistake that I see players make is misunderstanding like the flow of the game, like what I was actually talking about earlier. So a lot of players understanding a game in terms of what's going to happen over the course of several turns versus what's going to happen over the course of one turn is obviously a lot harder because you have to take into account so many other factors. But something that a lot of players do is just their turn will start. They'll just look at their hand. They're like, okay, I'm going to do this. This is the best thing I have available to me. So they do it. And the next turn, their opponent had a reaction that was a little bit disadvantageous to them. So they have to like reassess what they're doing. And so they reassess and they do their next thing. And it keeps going and eventually they lose. But instead of doing that, they could have thought about, okay, I'm going to make this first line of play. Where is it going to take me like several turns down the road? What's going to happen 3 turns from now versus what's going to happen to me next turn? And a lot of players tend to think about the game in just like smaller time windows instead of like expanding their thought process to what's going to happen way further down the line. And it's obviously like it's kind of hard to get in that mindset to not think about just like, you know, on a turn by turn basis. And there's a lot of things you can do to improve that. Like one thing that can help a lot is basically shortening your gameplay actions and then giving yourself time on your opponent's turn to be able to think about things. And shortening your gameplay actions also just gives you like more mental resources, going back to like the personal resource management. So a lot of players, I don't know, this would be a 1A as far as like biggest mistakes that I see a lot of players make. My 1A would be that a lot of players just take way too long and players play much slower than they ever should. Or they don't, I should say that they don't strive to get faster at the game. So like a lot of players, they'll watch, you know, someone at the Pro Tour who's fantastic. Like, for example, Gabriel Nassif, you know, Hall of Famer, has won like a bajillion Pro Tours. He has like 10 million top eights or something like that. Like he's, you know, top five players all time. If you watch him play, he's incredibly slow. He is very, very slow. And if you try to emulate that without his level of skill, you're not going to do very well. You're going to take a lot of time that you could instead be saving, you know, your mental energy, worrying about other things and like putting your thoughts and your focus on other parts of the game that require it. And a lot of like players at the local level, like let's say at the, you know, the PPDQ level or players that might spike and then get to the RPDQ, like there's a reason why a lot of RPDQs that I've attended have a lot of draws, because players play very slow when they're at that level because they think that playing slow means they're playing well. But that's not actually the case. Like playing slow just gives you more opportunities to really just screw up, in my opinion. I really do think that a lot of players should really like strive towards getting faster. Like if you want to think about it in terms of like, you know, your brain is like a computer or whatever, you want to increase your processing speed. You want to increase your RAM. You want to be able to make decisions faster at the same correctness. Because if you're making those decisions correctly at a faster rate, you have time to be able to make more decisions and be able to go through like more options and be able to think of new lines of play. And if you're taking so long trying to figure out how you're going to block on turn four with your two creatures when it's pretty easy, like you're kind of selling yourself short, in my opinion.
Yeah. Dang, that's really good. I like that analogy, and I think that's a really good point. And, you know, playing slow is not playing well, you know, and if you can increase your speed of thought pretty much, or the speed at which you're able to make these plays, then like you said, you can just consider more lines of play. So if you have the same amount of time, somebody who makes it through two lines of play versus somebody who makes it through five, you know, the guy who has made it through five, he just has more options open to him. He sees more possibilities and is able to make a better play. So love it. Now, have you learned something from Magic that you've been able to take to other aspects, other areas of your life?
I guess like the school of thought, not school of thought, but the practice with thinking through multiple different scenarios means that it's a lot easier for me to be able to come up with good suggestions at work or just be more efficient at work. So, I mean, a lot of times at work, you get trained, you kind of do things as you're trained. You don't really like reevaluate what you're doing. But with Magic, because everyone is so focused on being good or getting that edge, you know, like getting that knowledge that no one else has, people are always constantly reevaluating the way that they play or the way that, you know, like cards, like what they should be building and all these other types of things. So it kind of gives me this ability to continue to reevaluate like how I'm doing in my personal life or like how I'm doing at work. Like, okay, maybe I should do something slightly differently. Or maybe I should suggest that we try this different process or any of those types of actions.
That's awesome. That's really, really cool. And what are some of your shortcomings as a player? What are you working on within Magic to improve?
So my biggest shortcoming by a metric, by a mile, like with no contest, is my focus when I'm winning. So I know that there's plenty of players that also experience this. I'm not alone in this. But when I'm ahead or when I perceive that I'm ahead in a game, I tend to lose my focus pretty quickly because in my back of my head, I'm just like, oh, I'm winning. It doesn't matter. Blah, blah, blah. I'll just keep playing and I'll just win this game really quickly. But it turns out that I've had plenty of scenarios where, you know, I've been way ahead and then all of a sudden I lost Like if you want to take the most recent Super Bowl as your example of someone who was way ahead and they decided to ease up, the Atlanta Falcons certainly did not do themselves any favors by easing up in the fourth quarter. So yeah, I really am trying to focus more at all stages of the game and trying to not lose focus when I feel like I'm ahead, and that the focus thing is really where I'm like trying to really nail it down. Cause when I,
yeah, you're focusing on focus.
Well, right. Yeah. When I'm locked in, when I'm in the zone, I feel like very confident in my ability to like win any game that is like possible to win. Cause obviously like, you know, some games are unwinnable. Like that's something that I've learned over the last like couple of years that I've been able to really like use profitably is, you know, sometimes the cards that your opponent draws are going to be better than yours and you're just going to lose. Sometimes it just happens. You can't avoid it. Sometimes your opponent kills you on turn one and you don't have force of will and it's like, all right, well, I'm dead. Like those things happen, but there's a much, much, much wider range of games that are, you know, indeterminable unless you like basically utilize all the available like outs that you have. So whenever I'm locked in, I feel very confident about being able to win those games. Like the last year or so, I felt that I've had very few games that like when I'm locked in, I've actually lost due to like my play decisions. A lot of my losses I felt have been to, you know, bad luck, which happens, or to just losing my focus, and then that would cause my losses. So like that's the area that I'm trying to improve in right now.
Love it. Absolutely love it. And we love cheering on past guests. So what events what tournaments are you going to be going to here in the near future?
Let's see. So I'm going to be going to GP Pittsburgh, which is this upcoming weekend. I guess it'll be before this goes up, but that's coming up the weekend of the 11th and 12th or something like that. And then I will also be at the SAG Team Open in Baltimore, where I'm going to team with two of my local friends. We're going to try to take that one down. That'll be a fun time. Yeah, that I'm really excited for that tournament. There hasn't been a real true team constructed tournament in years, so I'm really excited to play in that one.
So once again, Prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Eric, you can do so on Twitter. He's @English_Eric. So reach out to him there, say thanks for being on the show, ask him a question. And Eric, as we pull into the home stretch here, what is one last parting piece of guidance you have for us? Either something that you already said that you'll emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end?
I guess I would say that the thing that I like, am so very happy about with this game is that it's just generally fun no matter which way I play it. Like, I mean, I play... When people ask me, you know, when I play this game, you know, like, oh, what do you play? Do you play standard? Do you play modern? Do you play EDH? And I was like, no, I just play the game. They're like, what? And I'm like, no, I just play everything. Like, is there a tournament? I'll just play it. Do I want to play casually? I'll just go play EDH. I'll go do a cube draft. I'll do anything. Like, I personally think that this game is the best game on the planet by insurmountable amount of distance. And I think that it doesn't matter how you play it. It's all just fun. So I really think that like, as far as the game goes, like being able to like maintain that like aspect of fun gives you like the enjoyment to be able to continue going to these tournaments. Cause I mean, I think that that's like the biggest difference between Magic and something else like poker or like certain esports, like League of Legends or like Counter-Strike, where a lot of those things, I mean, they're games in their original form, but the form that they've taken at this point has been much more of like a job. Like if you see players who like people who play poker in Las Vegas for a living, they don't really consider it a game anymore. It's a job. It's not as fun as it used to be. Like, sure, there's some fun moments, but there's much more of like that grind aspect that people experience when, you know, they work 40 hours a week, you know, their you know, full-time job or stuff like that. And Magic to me, like, you get to really enjoy the game while also like doing your best at the game. It has this like excellent balance of fun and effort that you get to put into it to really get like a benefit. And so like I really do think that like that's just like pretty like that. Maintaining that like fun aspect is like pretty crucial to just continuing to play the game and getting better at it. So, I mean, you can certainly get better at it if you just, you know, grind a bunch, but if you enjoy it at the same time, you're going to improve by at a much faster rate.
Well, Eric, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences with us. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it has been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed, always draw what you need, and depart every plane victorious.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it, Mr. Eric English. Thank you so much for being on the show. I know I learned a lot. As always, Prodigies, you can find the show notes at mtgpro2.com/Eric English. So just look them up there. You'll get a synopsis of what we talked about, as well as any links to resources that were mentioned. Before we wrap things up, I do want to remind you that this episode was brought to you by snapcardster.com/Kickstarter and the patrons. Snapcardster is the all-in-one magic app that they are kickstarting to move from the Android to iOS. So if you want to see what they have going on there and help support them, snapcardster.com/Kickstarter is where you can find that. And then the patrons, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been awesome this week to see several new signups, and I really appreciate your support. I look forward to many, many, many more MTG Pro Tour episodes and helping 1,000 players qualify for the Pro Tour. I cannot wait to have the first listener-turned-guest, and we are making waves in that direction. We have the podcast, we have the Facebook group, we have the newsletter, as well as other things that are coming out this year to really help people push their game forward and qualify for the Pro Tour. So thank you so much for being here listening. I really appreciate it. If you're looking for a way to give back and support the show, but becoming a patron is not where you're at right now, that's totally cool. Share it with a friend. If you could just share the show with a friend and say, hey, I like this podcast. I think it will help you improve. We all have magic friends who want to get better, right? And pretty much everybody has a device these days that they can listen to stuff. So sharing the show is a fantastic way that you can support it, and it doesn't cost a dime. So thank you so much for joining me today. I'm super pumped to watch the events going on this weekend, see what goes down. I hope at the very least you get out there and play some magic, whether that's at FNM or some other event. Good luck with that. And we'll get together again next week for some more fantastic interviews. Until then, I am Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery, be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.